Now I understand why King Stannis let the wildlings through the wall. He means for us to eat them.
John had to smile.
It will not come to that.
Oh, good, said Ed. They look a stringy lot, and my teeth are not as sharp as when I was younger.
If we had sufficient coin, we could buy food from the south and bring it in by ship, the Lord Steward said.
We could, thought John, if we had the gold and someone willing to sell us food. Both of those were lacking.
Our best hope may be the Eyrie. The Vale of Arryn was famously fertile and had gone untouched during the fighting. John wondered how Lady Caitlin's sister would feel about feeding Ned Stark's bastard. As a boy, he often felt as if the lady grudged him every bite.
"We can always hunt if need be," Wick Whittlestick put in. "There's still game in the woods."
"And wildlings and darker things," said Marsh.
"I would not send out hunters, my lord, I would not."
"No, you would close our gates forever and seal them up with stone and ice."
Half of Castle Black agreed with the Lord Steward's views, he knew. The other half heaped scorn on them.
"Seal our gates and plant your fat black arses on the wall. I and the free folk will come swarming over the Bridge of Skulls or through some gate you thought you'd sealed 500 years ago.
The old forester Dywin had declared loudly over supper 2 nights past.
"We don't have the men to watch 100 leagues of wall. Tormund Giantspot and the Bloody Weeper know it too. Ever see a duck frozen in a pond with his feet in the ice? It works the same for crows."
Most rangers echoed Dywin, whilst the stewards and builders inclined toward Burn Marsh. But that was a quandary for another day. Here and now the problem was food. "We cannot leave King Stannis and his men to starve, even if we wish to," John said. "If need be, he could simply take all this at sword point. We do not have the men to stop them. The wildlings must be fed as well."
"How, my lord?" asked Bowen Marsh.
"Would that I knew.
We will find a way." By the time they returned to the surface, the shadows of the afternoon were growing long. Clouds streaked the sky like tattered banners, grey and white and torn. The yard outside the armory was empty, but inside John found the king's squire awaiting him. Devon was a skinny lad of some 12 years, brown of hair and eye. They found him frozen by the forge, hardly daring to move as ghosts sniffed him up and down.
"He won't hurt you," John said, but the boy flinched at the sound of his voice, and that sudden motion made the direwolf bare his teeth.
"No," John said, "ghost, leave him be, away."
The wolf slunk back to his oxbone, silence on 4 feet. Devon looked as pale as ghost, his face damp with perspiration.
My lord, his grace commands your presence.
The boy was clad in Baratheon gold and black, with the flaming heart of a queen's man sewn above his own.
"You mean requests," said Dolorous Ed. "His grace requests the presence of the Lord Commander. That's how I'd say it."
"Leave it be, Ed." John was in no mood for such squabbles.
"Sir Richard and Sir Justin have returned," said Devon. "Will you come, my lord?"
Ah, the Rungway Rangers. Massianhorpe had ridden south, not north. Whatever they had learned did not concern the Night's Watch, but John was curious all the same. If it would please his grace, he followed the young squire back across the yard. Ghosts padded after them, until John said, "No, stay." Instead, the direwolf ran off. In the king's tower, John was stripped of his weapons and admitted to the royal presence. The solar was hot and crowded. Stannis and his captains were gathered over the map of the north. The Rungway Rangers were amongst them. Sigorn was there as well, the young Magna of Thenn, clad in a leather hauberk, sewn with bronze scales. Rattleshirt sat scratching at the manacle on his wrist with a cracked yellow fingernail. Brown stubble covered his sunken cheeks and receding chin,
and strands of dirty hair hung across his eyes.
"Here he comes," he said when he saw John, "the brave boy who slew Mance Rayder when he was caged and bound."
The big square-cut gem that adorned his iron cuff glimmered redly.
"Do you like my ruby, Snow? A token of love from Lady Red."
John ignored him and took a knee.
"Your Grace," announced Squire Devon, "I brought Lord Snow."
"I can see that. Lord Commander, you know my knights and captains, I believe."
"I have that honour."
He made it a point to learn all he could of the men around the king.
Queen's men all. It struck John as odd that there were no king's men about the king, but that seemed to be the way of it. The king's men had incurred Stannis' ire on Dragonstone, if the talk John heard was true.
"There is wine, or water boiled with lemons."
"Thank you, but no."
"As you wish. I have a gift for you, Lord Snow."
The king waved a hand at Rattleshirt.
"Him."
Lady Melisandre smiled.
"You did say you wanted men, Lord Snow. I believe our Lord of Bones still qualifies."
John was aghast. "Your Grace, this man cannot be trusted. If I keep him here, someone will slit his throat for him. If I send him ranging, he'll just go back over to the wildlings."
"Not me. I've done with those bloody fools."
Rattleshirt tapped the ruby on his wrist.
"Ask your red witch, bastard."
Melisandre spoke softly in a strange tongue. The ruby at her throat throbbed slowly, and John saw that the smaller stone on Rattleshirt's wrist was brightening and darkening as well. "So long as he wears the gem, he is bound to me, blood and soul," the Red Priestess said. "This man will serve you faithfully. The flames do not lie, Lord Snow." "Perhaps not," John thought. "But you do."
"I'll range for you, bastard," Rattleshirt declared. "I'll give you sage counsel, or sing you pretty songs, as you prefer. I'll even fight for you. Just don't ask me to wear your cloak."
"You're not worthy one," John thought, but he held his tongue. No good would come of squabbling before the king.
King Stannis said, "Lord Snow, tell me of Mors Umber."
"The Night's Watch takes no part," John thought. But another voice within him said, "Words are not swords." The elder of the great John's uncles, Crowfood they call him, a crow once took him for dead and picked out his eye. He caught the bird in his fist and bit its head off. When Mors was young, he was a fearsome fighter. His sons died on the Trident, his wife in childbed. His only daughter was carried off by wildlings 30 years ago. "That's why he wants the head," said Harwood Fell.
"Can this man Mors be trusted?" asked Stannis.
"Has Mors Umber bent the knee?" "Your Grace should have him swear an oath before his heart tree." Godfrey, the giant slayer, guffawed.
"I had forgotten that you Northmen worship trees."
"What sort of god lets himself be pissed upon by dogs?" asked Faring's crony, Clayton Suggs.
John chose to ignore them.
"Your Grace, might I know if the Umbers have declared for you?"
"Half of them, and only if I meet this Crowfood's price," said Stannis, in an irritated tone. "He wants Mance Rayder's skull for a drinking cup, and he wants a pardon for his brother, who has ridden south to join Bolton. Horsebane, he's called."
Sir Godfrey was amused by that as well.
"What names is Northmen have? Did this one bite the head off some more?"
John regarded him coolly. "You might say so. A whore who tried to rob him 50 years ago in Old Town." Odd as it might seem, old Hoarfrost Umber had once believed his youngest son had the makings of a maester. Mors loved to boast about the crow who took his eye. But Hother's tale was only told in whispers, most like because the whore he disemboweled had been a man. "Have other lords declared for Bolton too?" The Red Priestess slid closer to the king.
I saw a town with wooden walls and wooden streets, filled with men. Banners flew above its walls. A moose, a battle axe, three pine trees, long axes crossed beneath a crown. A horse's head with fiery eyes.
Ornwood, Serwin, Tallheart, Riswell, and Dustin, supplied Sir Clayton Soggs. Traitors all, lapdogs of the Lannisters.
The Riswells and Dustins are tied to House Bolton by marriage, John informed him. Those others have lost their lords in the fighting. I do not know who leads them now. Crow Food is no lapdog, though. Your Grace would do well to accept his terms. Stannis ground his teeth.
He informs me that Umber will not fight Umber for any cause.
John was not surprised. If it comes to swords, see where Hother's banner flies, and put Moore's on the other end of the line. The giant slayer disagreed.
You would make his grace look weak. I say, show our strength. Burn last horse to the ground and ride to war with Crow Food's head mounted on a spear as a lesson to the next lord who presumes to offer half his homage.
A fine plan, if what you want is every hand in the north raised against you. Half is more than none. The Umbers have no love for the Boltons. If Horsbane has joined the bastard, it can only be because the Lannisters hold the great John captive.
That is his pretext, not his reason, declared Sir Godfrey. If the nephew dies in chains, these uncles can claim his lands and lordship for themselves.
The great John has sons and daughters both. In the north, the children of a man's body still come before his uncle, sir.
Unless they die. Dead children come last everywhere.
Suggest that in the hearing of Moore's Umber, Sir Godfrey, and you will learn more of death than you might wish.
I have slain a giant boy. Why should I fear some flea-ridden Northman who paints one on his shield?
The giant was running away. Moore's won't be. The big knight flushed.
You have a bold tongue in the King's Solar, boy. In the yard you sang a different song.
Oh, leave off, Godfrey, said Sir Justin Massey, a loose-limbed, fleshy knight with a ready smile and a mop of flaxen hair. Massey had been one of the Wrongway Rangers. We all know what a big giant sword you have, I'm sure. No need for you to wave it in our faces yet again.
The only thing waving here is your tongue, Massey.
Be quiet, Stannis snapped.
Lord Snow, attend me. I have lingered here in the hopes that the wildlings would be fool enough to mount another attack upon the wall. As they will not oblige me, it is time I dealt with my other foes.
I see. John's tone was wary.
What does he want of me?
I have no love for Lord Bolton or his son, but the Night's Watch cannot take up arms against them. Our vows prohibit...
I know all about your vows. Spare me your rectitude, Lord Snow. I have strength enough without you. I have a mind to march against the Dreadfort.
When he saw the shock on John's face, he smiled.
Does that surprise you? Good. What surprises one Snow may yet surprise another. The bastard of Bolton has gone south, taking Hother Umber with him. On that, Moore's Umber and Arnulf Carstock are agreed. That can only mean a strike at Moat Cailin to open the way for his lord father to return to the north. The bastard must think I'm too busy with the wildlings to trouble him. Well and good. The boy has shown me his throat. I mean to rip it out. Roose Bolton may regain the north, but when he does, he will find his castle, herds and harvest all belong to me. If I take the Dreadfort unawares,
you won't, John blurted. It was as if he whacked a wasp's nest with a stick. One of the Queen's men laughed, one spat, one muttered a curse, and the rest all tried to talk at once.
The boy has milk water in his veins, said Sir Godfrey the Giant Slayer.
And Lord Sweet huffed. The craven sees an outlaw behind every blade of grass. Stannis raised a hand for silence. Explain your meaning.
Where to begin?
John moved to the map. Candles had been placed at its corners to keep the hide from rolling up. A finger of warm wax, slow as a glacier, was puddling out across the Bay of Seals. To reach the Dreadfort, your grace must travel down the King's Road, past the last river, turn south by east, and cross the lonely hills. He pointed. Those are Umberlands, where they know every tree and every rock. The King's Road runs along their western marches for 100 leagues. Mors will cut your host to pieces unless you meet his terms and win him to your cause.
Very well. Let us say I do that.
That will bring you to the Dreadfort, said John. But unless your host can outmarch a raven or a line of beacon fires, the castle will know of your approach. It will be an easy thing for Ramsay Bolton to cut off your retreat and leave you far from the wall without food or refuge, surrounded by your foes.
Only if he abandons his siege of Moat Cailin.
Moat Cailin will fall before you ever reach the Dreadfort. Once Lord Roos has joined his strength to Ramsay's, they will have you outnumbered 5-1. My brother won battles at worse odds.
You assume Moat Cailin will fall quickly, Snow, objected Justin Massey. But the Arnmen are doughty fighters, and I've heard it said that the moat has never been taken.
From the south. A small garrison in Moat Cailin can play havoc with any army coming up the causeway, but the ruins are vulnerable from the north and east. John turned back to Stannis. Sire, this is a bold stroke, but the risk... The Night's Watch takes no part. Baratheon or Bolton should be the same to me. If Roose Bolton should catch you beneath his walls with his main strength, it will be the end for all of you.
Risk is part of war, declared Sir Richard Hawp, a lean knight with a ravaged face, whose quilted doublet showed 3 death's-head moths on a field of ash and bone.
Every battle is a gamble, Snow. The man who does nothing also takes a risk.
There are risks and risks, Sir Richard. This one, it is too much, too soon, too far away. I know the Dreadfort. It is a strong castle, all of stone, with thick walls and massive towers. With winter coming, you will find it well provisioned. Centuries ago, House Bolton rose up against the king in the north, and Harland Stark laid siege to the Dreadfort. It took him 2 years to starve them out. To have any hope of taking the castle, your grace would need siege engines, towers, battering rams.
Siege towers can be raised, if need be, Stannis said. Trees can be felled for rams, if rams are required. Arn of Carstock writes that fewer than 50 men remain at the Dreadfort, half of them servants. A strong castle, weakly held, is weak.
50 men inside a castle are worth 500 outside.
That depends upon the men, said Richard Hawke. These will be grey beards and green boys, the men this bastard did not deem fit for battle. Our own men were blooded and tested on the Blackwater, and they are led by knights.
You saw how we went through the wildlings,
Sir Justin pushed back a lock of flaxen hair.
The Carstocks have sworn to join us at the Dreadfort, and we will have our wildlings as well, 300 men of fighting age. Lord Harwood made a count as they were passing through the gate. Their women fight as well.
Stannis gave him a sour look.
Not for me, sir. I want no widows wailing in my wake. The women will remain here, with the old, the wounded, and the children. They will serve as hostages for the loyalty of their husbands and fathers. The wildling men will form my van. The Magnar will command them with their own chiefs as sergeants. First, though, we must needs arm them.
He means to plunder our armory, John realized. Food and clothing, land and castles, now weapons. He draws me in deeper every day. Words might not be swords, but swords were swords. I could find 300 spears, he said, reluctantly. Helms as well, if you take them old and dinted and red with rust. Armor, asked the Magna, plate, mail. When Donald Noy died, we lost our armorer. The rest John left unspoken. Give the wildlings mail, and there'll be twice as great a danger to the realm.
Boiled leather will suffice, said Sir Godfrey. Once we've tasted battle, survivors can loot the dead.
The few who live that long. If Stannis placed the free folk in the van, most would perish quickly. Drinking from Mance Raider's skull may give Mors Umber pleasure, but seeing wildlings cross his lands will not. The free folk have been raiding the Umbers since the dawn of days, crossing the Bay of Seals for gold and sheep and women. One of those carried off was Crowfood's daughter. Your Grace, leave the wildlings here. Taking them will only serve to turn my Lord Father's bannerman against you. Your father's bannermen seem to have no liking for my cause in any case. I must assume they see me as, what was it that you call me, Lord Snow, another doomed pretender? Stannis stared at the map. For a long moment the only sound was the king grinding his teeth.
Leave me, all of you. Lord Snow, remain.
The brusque dismissal did not sit well with Justin Massey. But he had no choice but to smile and withdraw. Hawk followed him out, after giving John a measured look. Clayton Suggs drained his cup dry and muttered something to Harwood Fell that made the younger man laugh. Boy was part of it. Suggs was an up-jumped hedge knight, as crude as he was strong. The last man to take his leave was Rattleshirt. At the door he gave John a mocking bow, grinning through a mouthful of brown and broken teeth. All of you did not seem to include Lady Melisandre, the king's red shadow. Stannis called to Devon for more lemon water. When his cup was filled, the king drank and said,
Hope and Massey aspire to your father's seat. Massey wants a wildling princess, too. He once served my brother Robert as squire, and acquired his appetite for female flesh. Hawk will take Val to wife if I command it, but it is battle he lusts for. As a squire he dreamed of a white cloak, but Cersei Lannister spoke against him, and Robert passed him over. Perhaps rightly. Sir Richard is too fond of killing. Which would you have as Lord of Winterfell, Snow? The Smiler or the Slayer?
John said, Winterfell belongs to my sister, Sansa.
I've heard all I need to hear of Lady Lannister and her claim.
The king set the cup aside.
You could bring the North to me. Your father's bannermen would rally to the son of Eddard Stark, even Lord Too Fat to Sit a Horse. White Harbour would give me a ready source of supply, and a secure base to which I could retreat at need. It is not too late to amend your folly, Snow. Take a knee and swear that bastard sword to me, and rise as John Stark, Lord of Winterfell and Warden of the North.
How many times will he make me say it? My sword is sworn to the Night's Watch.
Stannis looked disgusted. Your father was a stubborn man as well. Honour, he called it. Well, honour has its costs, as Lord Eddard learned to his sorrow. If it gives you any solace, Hope and Massey are doomed to disappointment. I am more inclined to bestow Winterfell upon Arnulf Karstark, a good Northman.
A Northman. Better a Karstark than a Bolton or a Greyjoy, John told himself, but the thought gave him little solace. The Karstarks abandoned my brother amongst his enemies.
After your brother took off Lord Rickard's head. Arnulf was 1,000 leagues away. He has Stark blood in him, the blood of Winterfell.
no more than half the other houses of the north.
Those other houses have not declared for me.
Arnulf Carstark is an old man with a crooked back, and even in his youth he was never the fighter Lord Rickard was. The rigors of the campaign may well kill him.
He has heirs, Stannis snapped. 2 sons, 6 grandsons, some daughters. If Robert had fathered 2 born sons, many who are dead might still be living.
Your Grace would do better with Moor's crow food.
The Dreadfort will be the proof of that.
Then you mean to go ahead with this attack?
Despite the counsel of the great Lord Snow, aye. Horp and Massey may be ambitious, but they are not wrong. I dare not sit idle, whilst Roose Bolton's star waxes and mine wanes. I must strike and show the North that I am still a man to fear.
The Merman of Manderley was not amongst those banners Lady Melisandre saw in her fires, John said. If you had White Harbour and Lord Wyman's knights,
if is a word for fools. We have had no word from Davos. It may be he never reached White Harbour. Arnulf Carstark writes that the storms have been fierce upon the narrow sea. Be that as it may, I have no time to grieve, nor wait upon the whims of Lord Too Fat. I must consider White Harbour lost to me. Without a son of Winterfell to stand beside me, I can only hope to win the North by battle. That requires stealing a leaf from my brother's book. Not that Robert ever read one. I must deal my foes a mortal blow before they know that I am on them.
John realized that his words were wasted. Stannis would take the Dreadfort or die in the attempt. The Night's Watch takes no part, a voice said, but another replied, Stannis fights for the realm, the Iron Men for thralls and plunder. Your Grace, I know where you might find more men. Give me the wildlings, and I will gladly tell you where and how.
I gave you Rattleshirt. Be content with him.
I want them all.
Some of your own sworn brothers would have me believe that you are half a wildling yourself. Is it true?
To you they are only arrow fodder. I can make better use of them upon the wall.
Give them to me to do with as I will, and I'll show you where to find your victory, and men as well.
Stannis rubbed the back of his neck.
You haggle like a crone with a codfish, Lord Snow. Did Ned Stark father you on some fishwife? How many men?
2,000, perhaps 3.
3,000? What manner of men are these?
Proud, poor, prickly where their honour is concerned, but fierce fighters.
This had best not be some bastard's trick. Will I trade 300 fighters for 3,000? Aye, I will. I am not an utter fool. If I leave the girl with you as well, do I have your word that you will keep our princess closely?
She's not a princess.
As you wish, Your Grace. Do I need to make you swear an oath before a tree?
No. Was that a jape? With Stannis it was hard to tell.
Done, then. Now, where are these men?
You'll find them here. John spread his burned hand across the map, west of the King's Road and south of the Gift.
Those mountains?
Stannis grew suspicious.
I see no castles marked there, no roads, no towns, no villages.
The map is not the land, my father often said. Men have lived in the high valleys and mountain meadows for thousands of years, ruled by their clan chiefs. Petty lords, you would call them, though they do not use such titles amongst themselves. Clan champions fight with huge, two-handed greatswords, while the common men sling stones and batter one another with staffs of mountain ash. A quarrelsome folk, it must be said. When they are not fighting one another, they tend their herds, fish the Bay of Ice, and breed the hardiest mounts you'll ever ride.
And they will fight for me, you believe?
If you ask them,
why should I beg for what is owed me?
Ask, I said, not beg.
John pulled back his hand. "It is no good sending messages. Your Grace will need to go to them yourself. Eat their bread and salt, drink their ale, listen to their pipers, praise the beauty of their daughters and the courage of their sons, and you'll have their swords." The clans had not seen a king since Torren Stark bent his knee. "Your coming does them honour. Command them to fight for you, and they will look at one another and say, 'Who is this man? He is no king of mine.'" "How many clans are you speaking of?" "2 score, small and large. Flint, Wall, Norrie, Little. Win old Flint and Big Bucket. The rest will follow." "Big Bucket. The Wall, he has the biggest belly in the mountains and the most men. The Walls fish the Bay of Ice, and warn their little ones that Iron Man will carry them off if they don't behave. To reach them, your Grace must pass through the Norris lands, however. They live the nearest to the gift, and have always been good friends to the Watch. I could give you guides."
"Could?"
"Stannis miss little. Or will?"
"Will.
You'll need them. And some sure-footed Garrons, too. The paths up there are little more than goat tracks."
"Goat tracks?"
The king's eyes narrowed. "I speak of moving swiftly, and you waste my time with goat tracks." "When the young dragon conquered Dorne, he used a goat track to bypass the Dornish watchtowers on the Boneway."
"I know that tale as well. But Daeron made too much of it in that vainglorious book of his. Ships won that war, not goat tracks. Oakenfist broke the Planky Town and swept halfway up the Green Blood, whilst the main Dornish strength was engaged in the Prince's Pass."
Stannis drummed his fingers on the map. "These mountain lords will not hinder my passage?"
"Only with feasts. Each will try to outdo the other with his hospitality. My lord father said he never ate half so well as when visiting the clans."
"For 3,000 men, I suppose I can endure some pipes and porridge," the king said, though his tone begrudged even that. John turned to Melisandre. "My lady, fair warning. The old gods are strong in those mountains. The clansmen will not suffer insults to their heart trees." That seemed to amuse her.
"Have no fear, Jon Snow. I will not trouble your mountain savages and their dark gods. My place is here with you and your brave brothers."
That was the last thing Jon Snow would have wanted. But before he could object, the king said,
"Where would you have me lead these stalwarts, if not against the Dreadfort?"
Jon glanced down at the map. "Deepwood Mott." He tapped it with a finger. "If Bolton means to fight the Iron Men, so must you. Deepwood is a Mott and Bailey castle, in the midst of thick forest, easy to creep up on unawares. A wooden castle, defended by an earthen dike and a palisade of logs. The going will be slower through the mountains, admittedly, but up there your host can move unseen, to emerge almost at the gates of Deepwood."
Stannis rubbed his jaw. "When Balon Greyjoy rose the first time, I beat the Iron Men at sea, where they are fiercest. On land, taken unawares, I have won a victory over the wildlings and their king beyond the wall. If I can smash the Iron Men as well, the North will know it has a king again."
"And I will have 1,000 wildlings, thought John, "and no way to feed even half that number." Tyrion. The Shy Maid moved through the fog, like a blind man groping his way down an unfamiliar hall. Septa L'Amour was praying. The mist muffled the sound of her voice, making it seem small and hushed. Griff paced the deck, mail clinking softly beneath his wolfskin cloak. From time to time he touched his sword, as if to make certain that it still hung at his side. Raleigh Duckfield was pushing at the starboard pole, Yandry at the larboard. Ysilla had the tiller.
"I do not like this place," Holden Halfmaester muttered. "Frightened of a little fog," mocked Tyrion, though in truth there was quite a lot of fog. At the prow of the Shy Maid, young Griff stood with a third pole to push them away from hazards as they loomed up through the mists. The lanterns had been lit fore and aft, but the fog was so thick that all the dwarf could see from amidships was a light floating out ahead of him, and another following behind. His own task was to tend the brazier and make certain that the fire did not go out.
"This is no common fog, Hugahill," Ysilla insisted. "It stinks of sorcery, as you would know if you had a nose to smell it. Many a voyager has been lost here, pole boats and pirates and great river galleys, too. They wander forlorn through the mists, searching for a sun they cannot find until madness or hunger claim their lives. There are restless spirits in the air here, and tormented souls below the water."
"There's one now," said Tyrion. Off to starboard, a hand large enough to crush the boat was reaching up from the murky depths. Only the tops of two fingers broke the river's surface, but as the Shy Maid eased on past, he could see the rest of the hand rippling below the water, and a pale face looking up. Though his tone was light, he was uneasy. This was a bad place, rank with despair and death.
"Ysilla is not wrong. This fog is not natural."
Something foul grew in the waters here and festered in the air. Small wonder the stone men go mad.
"You should not make mock," warned Ysilla. "The whispering dead hate the warm and quick and ever seek for more damned souls to join them."
"I doubt they ever shroud my size." The dwarf stirred the coals with a poker.
"Hatred does not stir the stone men half so much as hunger."
Holden Halfmaester had wrapped a yellow scarf around his mouth and nose, muffling his voice.
"Nothing any sane man would want to eat grows in these fogs. Thrice each year the triarchs of Valentus send a galley upriver with provisions. But the Mercy ships are off late, and sometimes bring more mouths than food."
Young Griff said,
"There must be fish in the river." "I would not eat any fish taken from these waters," said Ysilla. "I would not."
"We do well not to breathe the fog either," said Holden. "Garin's curse is all about us."
"The only way not to breathe the fog is not to breathe."
"Garin's curse is only grayscale," said Tyrion. The curse was oft seen in children, especially in damp cold climes. The afflicted flesh stiffened, calcified, and cracked, though the dwarf had read that grayscale's progress could be stayed by limes, mustard poultices, and scalding hot bars, the maester said, or by prayer, sacrifice, and fasting, the septons insisted. Then the disease passed, leaving its young victims disfigured but alive. Maesters and septons alike agreed that children marked by grayscale could never be touched by the rarer mortal form of the affliction, nor by its terrible swift cousin, the Grey Plague. "Damp is said to be the culprit," he said. "Foul humours in the air, not curses."
"The conquerors did not believe either, Hugo Hill," said Ysilla. "The men of Valantis and Valeria hung Garin in a golden cage and made mock as he called upon his mother to destroy them. But in the night the waters rose and drowned them, and from that day to this they have not rested. They are down there, still beneath the water. They who were once the lords of fire, their cold breath rises from the murk to make these fogs, and their flesh has turned as stony as their hearts."
The stump of Tyrion's nose was itching fiercely. He gave it a scratch. "The old woman may be right. This place is no good. I feel as if I am back in the privy again, watching my father die." He would go mad as well if he had to spend his days in this grey soup, whilst his flesh and bones turned to stone. Young Griff did not seem to share his misgivings.
Let them try and trouble us. We'll show them what we're made of.
We are made of blood and bone, in the image of the father and the mother, said Septon Lamore. Make no vainglorious boasts, I beg you. Pride is a grievous sin. The stone men were proud as well, and the shrouded lord was proudest of them all.
The heat from the glowing coals brought a flush to Tyrion's face.
Is there a shrouded lord, or is he just some tale?
The shrouded lord has ruled these mists since Garin's day, said Yandri. Some say that he himself is Garin, risen from his watery grave.
The dead do not rise, insisted Holden Halfmaester, and no man lives 1,000 years.
Yes, there is a shrouded lord. There have been a score of them. When one dies, another takes his place. This one is a corsair from the Basilisk Islands, who believed the Roine would offer richer pickings than the summer sea.
Aye, I've heard that too, said Duck, but there's another tale I like better. The one that says he's not like t'other stone men, that he started as a statue till a grey woman came out of the fog and kissed him with lips as cold as ice.
Enough, said Griff. Be quiet, all of you.
Septa Lamore sucked in her breath. What was that?
Where? Tyrion saw nothing but the fog. The heat from the glowing coals brought a flush to his face.
Something moved. I saw the water rippling.
A turtle, the prince announced cheerfully. A big snapper, that's all it was.
He thrust his pole out ahead of them and pushed them away from a towering green obelisk. The fog clung to them, damp and chilly. A sunken temple loomed up out of the greyness as Yandri and Duck leaned upon their poles and paced slowly from prow to stern, pushing. They passed a marble stair that spiraled up from the mud and ended jaggedly in air. Beyond, half-seen, were other shapes, shattered spires, headless statues, trees with roots bigger than their boat.
"This was the most beautiful city on the river, and the richest," said Yandri. "Croyain, the festival city."
"Too rich," thought Tyrion.
"Too beautiful.
It is never wise to tempt the dragons."
The drowned city was all around them.
A half-seen shape flapped by overhead, pale leathery wings beating at the fog. The dwarf craned his head around to get a better look, but the thing was gone as suddenly as it had appeared. Not long after, another light floated into view.
"Boat!"
a voice called across the water, faintly.
"Who are you?"
"Shy maid,"
Yantri shouted back.
"Kingfisher, up or down?"
"Down. Hides and honey, ale and tallow."
"Up, knives and needles, lace and linen, spice wine."
"What word from old Valantis?"
Yantri called.
"War,"
the word came back.
"Where?" Griff shouted. "When?"
"When the year turns," came the answer. "Nisus and Malachor go hand in hand, and the elephants show stripes."
The voice faded as the other boat moved away from them. They watched its light dwindle and disappear.
"Is it wise to shout through the fog at boats we cannot see?" asked Tyrion. "What if they were pirates?"
They had been fortunate where pirates were concerned, slipping down Dagger Lake by night, unseen and unmolested. Once Doc had caught a glimpse of a hull that he insisted belonged to Euro, the unwashed. The shy maid had been upwind, however, and Euro, if Euro it had been, had shown no interest in them.
"The pirates will not sail into the Sorrows," said Yandri.
"Elephants with stripes," Griff muttered. "What is that about, Nisus and Malachor? Illyrio has paid Triarch Nisus enough to own him 8 times over.
"In gold or cheese?"
quipped Tyrion. Griff rounded on him.
"Unless you can cut this fog with your next witticism, keep it to yourself."
"Yes, father," the dwarf almost said. "I'll be quiet, thank you.
He did not know these Volantines, yet it seemed to him that elephants and tigers might have good reason to make common cause when faced with dragons.
Might be the cheesemonger has misjudged the situation. You can buy a man with gold, but only blood and steel will keep him true.
The little man stirred the coals again and blew on them to make them burn brighter.
I hate this. I hate this fog. I hate this place. And I am less than fond of Griff.
Tyrion still had the poison mushrooms he had plucked from the grounds of Illyrio's manse, and there were days when he was sore tempted to slip them into Griff's supper. The trouble was, Griff scarce seemed to eat. Duck and Yandri pushed against the poles. Ysilla turned the tiller. Young Griff pushed the shy maid away from a broken tower, whose windows stared down like blind black eyes. Overhead her sail hung limp and heavy. The water deepened under her hull until their poles could not touch bottom, but still the current pushed them downstream, until all Tyrion could see was something massive rising from the river, humped and ominous. He took it for a hill looming above a wooded island or some colossal rock overgrown with moss and ferns and hidden by the fog. As the shy mare drew nearer, though, the shape of it came clearer. A wooden keep could be seen beside the water, rotted and overgrown. Slender spires took form above it, some of them snapped off like broken spears. Roofless towers appeared and disappeared, thrusting blindly upward. Halls and galleries drifted past, graceful buttresses, delicate arches, fluted columns, terraces and bowers. All ruined, all desolate, all fallen. The grey moss grew thickly here, covering the fallen stones in great mounds and bearding all the towers. Black vines crept in and out of windows, through doors and over archways, up the sides of high stone walls. The fog concealed three-quarters of the palace, but what they glimpsed was more than enough for Tyrion to know that this island fastness had been 10 times the size of the Red Keep once, and 100 times more beautiful. He knew where he was. "The Palace of Love," he said softly. "That was the Roynor name," said Holden Halfmaester. "But for 1,000 years this has been the Palace of Sorrow." The ruin was sad enough, but knowing what it had been made it even sadder. There was laughter here once, Tyrion thought. There were gardens, bright with flowers, and fountains sparkling golden in the sun. These steps once rang to the sound of lovers' footsteps, and beneath that broken dome marriages beyond count were sealed with a kiss. His thoughts turned to Tysha, who had so briefly been his lady wife. It was Jamie, he thought, despairing. He was my own blood, my big, strong brother. When I was small, he brought me toys, barrel hoops and blocks, and a carved wooden lion. He gave me my first pony and taught me how to ride him. When he said that he had bought you for me, I never doubted him. Why would I? He was Jamie, and you were just some girl who played a part. I had feared it from the start, from the moment you first smiled at me and let me touch your hand. My own father could not love me. Why would you, if not for gold? Through the long grey fingers of the fog, he heard again the deep shuddering thrum of a bowstring snapping taut. The grunt Lord Tywin made as the quarrel took him beneath the belly, the slap of cheeks on stone, as he sat down to die.
"Wherever whores go," he said.
"And where is that?" Tyrion wanted to ask him. "Where did Tysha go, father? How much more of this fog must we endure?" "Another hour should see us clear of the sorrows," said Holden Halfmaester. "From there on there should be a pleasure cruise. There's a village round every bend along the lower Rhoyne,
orchards and vineyards and fields of grain ripening in the sun, fisher folk on the water, hot bars and sweet wines. Selhoris, Valassan, and Volunthiris are walled towns so large they would be cities in the Seven Kingdoms. I believe I'll...
Light ahead!
Warned young Griff. Tyrion saw it too. Kingfisher or another pearl boat, he told himself. But somehow he knew that was not right. His nose itched. He scratched at it savagely. The light grew brighter as the shy maid approached it. A soft star in the distance, it glimmered faintly through the fog, beckoning them on. Shortly it became two lights, then three, a ragged row of beacons rising from the water. The Bridge of Dream, Griff named it. There will be stone men on the span. Some may start to wail at our approach, but they are not like to molest us. Most stone men are feeble creatures, clumsy, lumbering, witless. Near the end, they all go mad, but that is when they are most dangerous. If need be, fend them off with the torches. On no account let them touch you. They may not even see us, said Holden Halfmaster. The fog will hide us from them until we are almost at the bridge. Then we will be past before they know that we are here. Stone eyes are blind eyes, thought Tyrion. The mortal form of Greyscale began in the extremities, he knew. A tingling in a fingertip, a toenail turning black, a loss of feeling. As the numbness crept into the hand, or stole past the foot and up the leg, the flesh stiffened and grew cold, and the victim's skin took on a greyish hue, resembling stone. He had heard it said that there were three good cures for Greyscale, axe and sword and cleaver. Hacking off afflicted parts did sometimes stop the spread of the disease, Tyrion knew, but not always. Many a man had sacrificed one arm or foot, only to find the other going grey. Once that happened, hope was gone. Blindness was common when the stone reached the face. In the final stages, the curse turned inward to muscles, bones, and inner organs. Ahead of him, the bridge grew larger. The Bridge of Dream, Griff called it, but this dream was smashed and broken. Pale stone archers marched off into the fog, reaching from the Palace of Sorrow to the river's western bank. Half of them had collapsed, pulled down by the weight of the grey moss that draped them and the thick black vines that snaked upward from the water. The broad wooden span of the bridge had rotted through, but some of the lamps that lined the way was still aglow. As the shy maid grew closer, Tyrion could see the shapes of stone men moving in the light, shuffling aimlessly around the lamps like slow grey moths. Some were naked, others clad in shrouds. Griff drew his longsword.
Yolo, light the torches. Lad, take Lamore back to her cabin and stay with her.
Young Griff gave his father a stubborn look.
"'Lamore knows where her cabin is. I want to stay.'
"'We are sworn to protect you,' Lamore said softly.
"'I don't need to be protected. I can use a sword as well as duck. I'm half a knight.'
"'And half a boy,' said Griff. "'Do as you're told, now.'
The youth cursed under his breath and flung his pole down onto the deck. The sound echoed queerly in the fog, and for a moment it was as if poles were falling around them.
"'Why should I run and hide? Holden is staying, and Ysella, even you go.'
"'Aye,' said Tyrion, "'but I am small enough to hide behind a duck.'
He thrust half a dozen torches into the brazier's glowing coals and watched the oiled rags flare up. "'Don't stare at the fire,' he told himself. The flames would leave him night-blind.'
"'You're a dwarf,' young Griff said scornfully. "'Oh, my secret is revealed,' Tyrion agreed.
"'Aye, I'm less than half a Holden, and no one gives a mama's fart whether I live or die, least of all me. You, though, you are everything.'
"'Dwarf,' said Griff, "'I warned you.'
A wail came shivering through the fog, faint and high. Lamore whirled, trembling.
"'Seven, save us all.'
The broken bridge was a bare 5 yards ahead. Around its piers, the water rippled white as the foam from a madman's mouth. 40 feet above, the stone men moaned and muttered beneath a flickering lamp. Most took no more notice of the shy maid than of a drifting log. Tyrion clutched his torch tighter and found that he was holding his breath. And then they were beneath the bridge, white walls heavy with curtains of grey fungus looming to either side, water foaming angrily around them. For a moment it looked as though they might crash into the right-hand pier, but Duck raised his pole and shoved off, back into the centre of the channel, and a few heartbeats later they were clear. Tyrion had no sooner exhaled than young Griff grabbed hold of his arm.
"What do you mean? I am everything. What did you mean by that? Why am I everything?"
"Why?" said Tyrion. "If the stone men had taken Yantri, or Griff, or our lovely L'Amour, we would have grieved for them and gone on, lose you, and this whole enterprise is undone, and all those years of feverish plotting by the cheesemonger and the eunuch would have been for naught. Isn't that so?" The boy looked to Griff.
"He knows who I am."
"Ah, if I did not know before, I would now." By then the shy maid was well downstream of the Bridge of Dream. All that remained was a dwindling light astern, and soon enough that would be gone as well.
"You're young Griff, son of Griff the Sellsword," said Tyrion, "or perhaps you are the warrior in mortal guise.
Let me take a closer look." He held up his torch so that the light washed over young Griff's face.
"Leave off,"
Griff commanded,
"or you will wish you had."
The dwarf ignored him. "The blue hair makes your eyes seem blue. Oh, that's good. And the tale of how you color it in honor of your dead Tirashi mother was so touching, it almost made me cry. Still, a curious man might wonder why some sellsword's whelp would need a soiled scepter to instruct him in the faith, or a chainless maester to tutor him in Istrian tongues, and a clever man might question why your father would engage a hedge knight to train you in arms instead of simply sending you off to apprentice with one of the free companies. It is almost as if someone wanted to keep you hidden while still preparing you for what? Now, there's a puzzlement, but I'm sure that in time it will come to me. I must admit you have noble features for a dead boy." The boy flushed. "I'm not dead."
"How not? My lord father wrapped your corpse in a crimson cloak and laid you down beside your sister at the foot of the Iron Throne, his gift to the new king. Those who had the stomach to lift the cloak said that half your head was gone."
The lad backed off a step, confused.
"Your father, aye.
Tywin of House Lannister. Perhaps you may have heard of him."
Young Griff hesitated.
"Lannister? Your father is dead,
at my hand. If it please your grace to call me Yellow or Hugo, so be it. But know that I was born Tyrion of House Lannister, true-born son of Tywin and Joanna, both of whom I slew. Men will tell you that I am a kingslayer, a kinslayer, and a liar, and all of that is true. But then we are a company of liars, are we not? Take your feigned father, Griff, is it?" The dwarf sniggered. "You should thank the gods that Varys the Spider is a part of this plot of yours. Griff would not have fooled the cockless wonder for an instant, no more than he did me. No lord, my lordship says, no knight. And I'm no dwarf. Just saying a thing does not make it true. Who better to raise Prince Rhaegar's infant son than Prince Rhaegar's dear friend John Connington, once Lord of Griffin's Roost, and Hand of the King?"
"Be quiet!"
Griff's voice was uneasy. On the larboard side of the boat, a huge stone hand was visible just below the water. Two fingers broke the surface.
How many of those are there?
Tyrion wondered.
A trickle of moisture ran down his spine and made him shudder. The sorrow